And I'm actually hardwired in today because I was trying to avoid this. I don't understand what's up and 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 what's up.
I'm Andrew Riley, and this is Drupal Easy Podcast number 93. Wow, I almost forgot the number. It's on the screen in front of me. With us, we have a slightly lighter crew today. How's it going, Mike?
All right, Mr. Riley, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited about Turkey Day coming up for those of you who listen in the U.S. and for the rest of the people. Thursday is going to be awesome for you anyway.
Andrew, let's talk about you for a second, shall we?
Okay.
Because I just realized, or I think I realized for the second time, as we talked about it earlier or late last week, that you have a new title. That's yes. Fairly impressive.
Yes, I am now the Director of Drupal Development at MediaCurrent.
Are there other kinds of development that are going on at MediaCurrent that you're not privy to?
It's some of the front-end type stuff, so yes.
But you are the hardcore Drupal nerd at MediaCurrent.
Pretty much,
one of them,
yeah.
I should say.
Yeah, I'm one of them. I lead the hardcore group. How about that?
And all of the perks and privileges that go along with that title.
Every single one of them.
Which are, go ahead, just name them.
I've got a new title.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. Yeah.
Okay, fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you, though. And also with us, we have our special guest, Cindy McCourt. How's it going, Cindy?
Hi, it's going good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Before the call, we were talking. Your husband and dog are okay on the other side of the house, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, so I don't want to give too much information around you because you are our top story, and, well, I suppose your work as well is part of the top story. So, Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about Cindy for a little bit.
Yeah, well, Cindy, we actually we decided to ask you on the podcast because someone that we know down in South Florida, we were at Drupal Camp South Florida, and we were talking about Drupal books and recommendations, and there's normally two or three that I normally recommend to aspiring developers. And this guy I know basically said, oh, there's one book that you're missing. It's this book about how to plan your website before you even start like doing the technical stuff. It's all about like things to ask your clients and all the stuff you have to get together. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, what book are you talking about? And he had no idea of your name nor the title. So that didn't really help until about a week later when he emailed me. And this guy, his name is Ron. He's from, I think, Miami Beach. So Ron emailed me, and sure enough, the name of the book is Drupal, The Guide to Planning and Building Websites, written by you, our guest, Cindy. So this is a book that was published over a year ago, and somehow it's flown underneath our radar. I think it was, you corrected me, it was July 2011, correct?
Yes.
And this is a very different kind of Drupal book, at least from the ones that we've, or I've reviewed, or we've interviewed on the podcast, in that this is a book that is not going to tell you how to build a Drupal site, or at least the tech. Yeah, it's not going to say install Drupal, enable this module, click this button. This is pretty much a book that describes everything you should be doing, not only before you start that, but from a process standpoint during that, during the building and after.
Yes.
And as I was talking to Andrew this morning, I basically said, this is the book that if you are a project manager in Drupal or an aspiring project manager, this book is like your definitive guide to Drupal 7. Is that, you think that's a fair statement?
The word definitive is so absolute, but yes. I wrote it for managers who need to understand the process from start to finish and understand Drupal and how Drupal fits into that process.
And I think that's one thing that you definitely touched on, not even touched on, but you hammered away through the book was the fact that you could know project management inside and out, but you really also need to have a firm understanding of Drupal capabilities in order to be a good Drupal project manager.
Yes, yes, definitely. Because the way some development teams are managed, I've seen this before, you know, a lot of the entities of a project are separated, like the wireframers or the graphic artists and content people. And if they're kept separate from each other, you can really run into problems because there's certain, if you want a very Drupal-y site, if you want something that's not extremely customized and take a long time to build, you need people together, working together and understanding how Drupal works so that decisions are made in context of how Drupal functions.
So what's your background? I mean, I see here that you're an instructional designer, but what does that mean? Like, what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
I'm an instructional designer, and I don't do a whole lot with that. I guess I use some of my instructional designer skills in writing this book, and definitely in helping write Steve Berg's new Drupal Explained, Drupal 7 Explained, coming out here in a few months. I do training materials, but my background, what gave me a lot of insights in writing this book, was I spent years with a company called TRW and worked with the project managers there, a lot of engineers, lots of really smart people, and a little bit rubbed off. I watched what they were doing and took notes. And then just working with different systems, coming up with, helping my clients design systems and field them, and just, the lessons and the heartaches you go through. And it's like, gosh, there's got to be an easier way, and I should tell people about this. So, I found myself just repeating the same things over and over again. I'm like, I'm going to write this down. So I actually started blogging this process originally.
So, I mean, do you see that? I mean, you were with TRW, which is obviously a private organization, or not private, but a for-profit company as opposed to the Drupal community, which is open source. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far from a project management standpoint, are the methods different?
No, because if you're when it comes to project management, this may be an open source, application, but when you have a project, you're typically in it for the money. And if you're not in it for the money, you still need to be efficient because you don't want to spend a lot of effort doing something, especially for, doing it for free. So project management is important, whether you're for profit or non-profit or whatever.
So from some of the background material I read, it seems like you're active in the Drupal community quite a bit. And one of the ways you're active is as somewhat of a cat herder. helping to organize. I mean, the one big, I read a blog post from Addie Berry about, I think it was, was it Drupal Camp Toronto? Is that right?
Yeah, a long time ago, yeah.
Right. Were you actually kind of organized a code sprint?
It was a doc sprint. It was a doc sprint.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was actually planning how to reshape Drupal's documentation. This is before 7 launched, obviously. So I was doing a little bit of that at DrupalCon DC. And they said, hey, we have this sprint coming up. Come up to Toronto. And I'm like, okay. So we spent a couple days locked in a hotel room and talked about how to reorganize Drupal's documentation. And
so, I mean, for things like that, are you more of the facilitator, just kind of helping to provide the structure of the discussions, or how does that work exactly?
In that particular case, I made sure that I focused simply on being the facilitator. When you run a meeting like that, whether you're a subject matter expert or not, or whether you're, at least something about the subject matter, if you're the facilitator, you're the facilitator, and you do not, become a participant unless there's, some struggles or some clarification needed or whatever. My job was to make sure that the people in the room move their conversation forward, things were documented and organized and so on.
All right. So are you still involved with things like that in the community?
Right now, my involvement is with giving out some Drupal training. On November 29th in the DC area, we are going to have 3 nights every Thursday in a row where we're going to teach people Drupal, beginner stuff, obviously. So get the ball rolling. And there's quite a waiting list. We're thinking about running some in maybe January, February as well.
So are those free trainings, or people have to pay to go to those?
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying to figure out a way to give back, and it's like, okay, I do training all the time. It's not going to be anything fancy or formal. You know, I'm not going to hand out materials or anything like that. We're going to get together for an hour and a half each night, and I'm going to walk them through a series of lessons. And at the end, they will have a simple website, you know, that they can play with and put on a server if they want, or rebuild, or whatever.
Oh, fantastic. All right, well, let's get back to the book a little bit. So, you know, as I alluded to earlier, this is not a book on how to build a Drupal site from a technical standpoint. So I guess walk me through the genesis of this book. Was this your idea where you went to some publishers and pitched it, or did someone approach you about writing this type of book?
Well, there's two perspectives on this. On my trip to Toronto, I was in the car for a few hours with Emma Jane Hogben, and her first book had just come out. And she says, you should just write about what you know, because I was, you know, in awe of her ability to put this book together. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, a little time after that, I, you know, kept thinking about it, ideas kept coming up. And I realized the thing that I knew the most, you know, that hadn't already been written, you know, was the management process, all the processes that you go through in planning the site, because that was where some of my strength laid, was in the management aspects and the planning aspects. So I started putting down some notes, and I played around. I contacted a couple of publishers that they said, no, we're more interested in the, like, you know, the click-oriented book. This is theory. We don't want theory. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I just put it out on a blog on planningdrupalsites.com, and apparently a technical editor from Wiley found it. He said it helped him with a large project he was working on, because he needed some help in just getting his head wrapped around the planning process for it. And he recommended it. So Wiley contacted me and said, do you want to make a book? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So there we have it.
Yeah. All right. So let's dive into, some of the, so I think as I was talking to Andrew earlier, I said the book kind of snuck up on me, because I got an electronic version of the book as a PDF, and you know, a short PDF weighs exactly the same as a large PDF. So I didn't realize the scope of the book until I was about 3 days in. And I'm like, I wonder how long this book is. And, you know, it's a good, like, 400 and something pages. So,
yep.
And the type is really small.
Yeah, tell me about it.
But the book's broken up into three big sections. One of them is planning your website. And to be honest, that's the one that I went through in the most detail and took a bunch of notes on. The second part is building and sustaining. And then the third part is an example site, meaning kind of you take all of the examples and all of the options and all of the requirements you talk about in the first two sections and actually create an example site out of them, as far as here are the requirements for this example site, here are the wireframes for this example site. But looking at the first part, because again, that's where I was able to spend my time, on the planning your website, you talk about everything from, development methodologies to levels of specification and requirements and wireframes to a level of detail that I am willing to bet most, you know, development shops haven't thought about. I think a lot of development shops have their one way of doing things and may not venture too far outside that box.
Yeah, I would say that's probably very true.
Yeah. So I guess my question for you, Cindy, is, how do you, as a project manager, how do you implement these changes? Or, you know, if a project manager reads one of your books, you know, what strategies could they use to kind of, you know, move the glacier a little bit to the left? Type of thing.
The first thing they need to do is understand the processes that they do use. Mm-hmm. They need to, for themselves, they need to pinpoint where they feel that they're the weakest, maybe from lessons learned from projects they performed, maybe delivered. And then take a look at, you know, read the sections in my book that are most applicable to them. I mean, not everything is going to apply to everybody. This was written for a wide audience. And see, you know, if there's any ideas. Say, hey, you know, oh, yeah, she talks about three things here, two of which we're already aware of. We just kind of do this. We didn't even think about it, but we already do it. Should we consider the third one? No, that doesn't make sense for us. Or, yeah, we could put that here. I think each organization needs, because each organization is made up with a different quantity of people, and then of the people that an organization has, they have different skill sets, and they have focus on different types of Drupal sites sometimes, you know, some more e-commerce versus, you know, other types mm-hmm. of sites. And so depending on how they work internally, you know, they know, just like I said, they know how they do it now, see what's broken, see how it should be, and maybe even, you know, get some ideas to see how they ultimately could be in the future and work towards that piece by piece. But always plan it. Don't just dive in and say, now we're going to do something different because, you know, all you're going to do is confuse people because they haven't had a chance to process what that difference is.
I think part of it also has to be the fact that it needs to be sold on the efficiency. Like the process is going to become more efficient, and therefore we're going to be able to better serve our clients and make more money.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of detail in my book and a lot of steps that I have listed. And, you know, some might think, well, oh my gosh, you know, how's that even efficient? And it's not so much, you know, doing every single thing that I've written down. It's just simply being aware of them and using them and employing them when it's appropriate. And that's what's important here is that there, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on here that you may not ever touch on, or there's going to be a lot of things on your project that my book doesn't even cover because they're so advanced. So, you know.
And that kind of leads me into, you know, my next question was, you know, there's Drupal shops of all different sizes, from, you know, one person shops to, you know, really large shops that have dedicated project managers for different projects. So let's talk. I know a good deal of our listeners are smaller shops. How much of an effort is required to adopt, you know, let's say a waterfall or an agile methodology? And what kind of gains could a small shop expect from adopting something, as opposed to just the seat of your pants method?
I think you can.
Yeah, you know, on the spot, I know.
You know, when you have a methodology, you have a roadmap. It's like getting in the car. It's just, you know, where are you going? I'm heading west. Where in west? I don't know, but this road kind of heads west. I'll head in that direction. I mean, it's not a very efficient approach. But if you have the things that you need to accomplish laid out in front of you. If you're in a situation where your client isn't ready to be at step three, but, you know, you should be at step three, you know, it's like, okay, they want to be at step two or they want to be at step five. You know, they want to be like way down the process and stuff. If you know what your roadmap is, if you know all the things, the steps and that you need to perform, you can dive in at any place you want and work with that and say, okay, my client wants to be here or we need to be at this point, but I know there's 10 things I haven't done yet. Because I know those 10 things, I know how they're going to affect me or not affect the step that I'm trying to perform right now out of sync. And so you can work with bringing yourself in and out of the process appropriately. That's why, you know, I find it interesting, like with waterfall. I mean, anyone can pick up waterfall, say you do this and then you do this. You just read my book, right? One step at a time.
Yeah.
But in reality, that's so not what it is. And, you know, in reality, when people say, you know, oh, we're doing the waterfall approach, in reality, they really don't, because there's always an opportunity. It's called configuration management. It's been around for, I don't know, 50 years. Whereas you're in the middle of a development process and, you know, you can actually change the requirements during development. Then there's agile, you know, everyone wants to be agile. And I think what I've witnessed and seen is a lot of people they think agile is a way of cutting corners and doing things on the fly. And it has some of that flexibility, but it's not about cutting corners. It's about doing it right, but doing it in such a way that you're building one thing after the next, you know, and you're learning what you need and making decisions as you go. It's not a shortcut on documentation. It's not a shortcut on testing. It's not now we can do it so much faster because I can only give them 24 hours, you know, and they'll work magic. So there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about Agile. I think Agile is great. I think it's a great process as long as you do it correctly.
I've always looked at Agile as it's great for clients who don't know what they want at the start and know that they don't know what they want. And it's a way for development to progress and kind of learning as you go.
Yes, I think it is. But my only warning is that if you have a limited budget, it could cost you.
Spiral wildly out of control.
Yeah, and you can only get like half of what you want done because you were like, oh, I wonder what this works or that works, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, your experience with, in the Drupal community, I mean, I think most shops use something agile-ish. I mean, is that your experience? And then from talking to people, is that the case? Is agile the prevalent, you know, development methodology these days, or is there something else?
I would venture to say that from the area that I live, I'm so close to Washington, D.C., you know, and so a lot of the business up there is big stuff, you know, it's big contracts, and there's money to be spent, and there's, you know, a lot of decisions that haven't been made, so therefore we need to be flexible, there's agile. But when you come to the smaller projects, So when I'm on a big one, I tend to be in a more agile environment. When I'm working with another client, it's basically their project. When I have my own projects and I'm working with like a church or something, or you know, one man show or whatever, you know, he just needs that. I tend to be more waterfallish because I want to make sure that I understand what they want and I can get it done within the budget. So I work with them very closely before we start developments because I don't want to start developing things and putting it in front of them and find out that I'm spending twice the number of hours that I bid because I didn't talk to them beforehand. You know, I didn't explain things to them. And that was actually one of the, you know, like, gosh, I'm saying things over and over again, hence why I wrote the book. So, teaching them what they need to understand about Drupal so they can make the right decisions so I can give them the product they need and the product that they can maintain after I'm gone. And that's really important. So I think it's just the size of the project and the budget is going to be two major factors for me in recognizing which methodology is going to be useful.
So it sounds like, and, you know, I think I'm on the same page that there's a strong correlation between, you know, lower budget, smaller projects tend to use waterfall, where larger budget, more complex projects tend to use agile. Is that a fair statement?
I'd risk that. Yeah. I don't have, I've never done the statistics on it, but you know, as you're thinking about it, yeah, that's probably true.
Andrew, what do you guys do at MediaCart?
It's actually a mixture. It depends on the project size, like you were just saying. So, waterfall and or agile.
Cindy, you covered a few other ones in the book. RAD, and I don't remember. RAD's the one I remember. But, I mean, are there any other methodologies in use, I'll say? You know, I'm sure there's oddball ones here and there, but... do waterfall and agile cover pretty much, you know, 90% of what we've seen in the Drupal community?
I would venture to say that phased, you know, a phased approach is also utilized in the community. It's like, you know, I want 10 types of things on my site, you know, from a community area to an e-commerce piece to a library to, you know, whatever, you know, these major functionalities and major sections of your site. But I only have the money for the one. So let's build that and let's bring in some business and let's see if we can get people interested in this. And then once I have my buy-in, I'll be able to convince someone maybe to give me more money and I'll do the next piece and the next piece, a phased approach.
Yeah. But then where each phase can almost have a development methodology of its own, correct?
Yes.
Phase one can do waterfall. And, you know, if phase two is a little bit bigger, maybe you do phase two agile.
Exactly. And then on another phase, you can take a RAD approach where you're doing a lot of prototyping because you're going into an area that no one's ever gone before. So you're off in a sandbox testing things and saying, oh, maybe we could try this way or try it that way. And in fact, I tend to do a little bit of that on just one section. It's like, okay, Drupal community has four ways of getting this done. sometimes they have 10 ways, you know. So let's do it all four ways, get four examples out there and see what's really going on with these modules and see how they're going to integrate with what we want to do in other aspects of the site, especially if we haven't tried those four ways, because there's so many modules out there that you can't try them all, right? So, so you get in there, you do a little prototyping, see if you like the way this works, you know. And on fresh development, it's like, hey, this is where we are. And here, dear client, you know, are you liking this? You know, is this working for you? Yes, you see what we want, but can we change this a little bit? So then you're back into that cycle of tweaking the design and then putting it in front of them for another, you know, for more testing and more testing. That's more of a RAD approach where you're you just dive in and you start developing.
So it sounds like, you know, since we can have development methodologies inside of development methodologies, I'm going to use my favorite movie reference once again. We have project management inception. Dream inside a dream inside a dream.
Just don't hit limbo.
So, another section of the book that I found really, really interesting because it kind of hit the hammer. I can't even, what is wrong
on the head? Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Was talk about the, you know, where you list the different ways to specify a project. I'm going from the most generic to the most specific. And this is something that, you know, at Drupal Easy, we do all the time. And I never knew there was a name for it or let alone a structure for it, where depending on the complexity of the project or the budget of the client or any one of a number of factors, there's different ways to specify a project, different levels of detail that you can get into. And I actually wrote down the four sections that you have listed here, or the four ways of doing it. In its most general, you can specify a project purely by its purpose. You know, what is the purpose of the website? If you want to be a little more specific, you do simple use cases. Even more specific, you start writing specifications. And it's most specific is you actually start writing configuration. You know, set this module's configuration to X, Y, and Z. And I thought that was really interesting because we've kind of always been doing that depending on the size and scope of the project. But to see it kind of formalized was very interesting and actually kind of helpful to us. So these four levels of specifying a project, are these things that you came up with, or is this kind of a standard way of doing things that's, you know, new to me, to be, you know, to be frank?
I've never seen it like this before. I mean, it's not that these four things are, you know, brand new. I mean, everyone knows what a purpose is and a use case is and specs versus configuration. We all know what those things are. But I was having a conversation with someone and they said, oh, here's my requirements. And I'm like, those aren't requirements. That's just simply the purpose of the site. Or, you know, and I realize I'm like, when I write this requirements chapter, and that people need to understand what it means to have requirements. And everyone has their own opinion of what that means. So that's why I started at the beginning of that chapter by saying, you know, you can go as detailed as you want. Here's four levels of detail, but know that the more granular you get, the higher the probability you'll get what you're asking for. And that's why the book takes, you know, people through so much detail, is so that you can go almost to the configuration level, because there are tips, you know, here's a module that does this and here's a module that does that. So you can actually get a little bit into configuration.
Yeah, I was kind of impressed because as I was reading it, I was kind of thinking about the projects that we've done in the past year, and definitely the smaller projects, we were given little more than a purpose for the website, or maybe a purpose and a couple of use cases. But for larger projects, we were definitely given all of that plus, you know, wireframes and screenshots and, you know, one of the admins should be able to go in and do these four very specific tasks. And it seems like it's definitely the larger the scope of the project, we tend to see the more specific requirements. I don't think that's, you know, really a shock to anybody. But as far as approaching a client or working with a client, would you recommend that kind of people work down that list, like start with the purpose, then go to simple use cases, then go to specifications and get more and more granular as you go? Is that kind of like the best way to do things?
I think ultimately you end up doing this. You know, from if the client, if your client's doing this without you, you know, it's like, you know, the shop that needs the website, you know, the organization or whatever that needs the website, they could sit here and they could create 1 through 4 and hand it to you, the developer. Or they can walk in and say, hey, developer, I have this site I want to do. I know its purpose. Can you help me do everything else? I quite often, depending on what's being asked, sometimes the use cases are very limited. Sometimes they're extremely detailed. And sometimes the configuration, because they're asking for things that are so obvious, you know, oh, gosh, we have configured this, I don't know, 100 times before. We don't need to really document it in that deep, much detail. Just let's go and just get it done, because in general, I know how to set up organic groups. So it just, you know, so you don't have to document that necessarily. It just depends. Do it the way that works for you, and just simply look at the options that I'm presenting and go from there. I don't want anyone to think that I'm trying to tell people how to do things or how they should do things. I'm saying, here's some things to think about and, you know, work with what works for you.
All right. So Cindy, another thing that your book has that I really, really enjoyed was you actually give a few lessons on how to create wireframes. Not only like kind of the background information on what is a wireframe and, you know, why are they useful, but the process of actually creating them. Can you talk about that a little bit and how, I mean, is that something you see as being almost required for sites or for site planning?
I think it is. And it doesn't, they don't have to be, you know, spectacular in my opinion. You know, the objective is to get a feel for how, the client wants the site laid out or how you want to convey a design structure to the client. Now granted, some clients can't visualize a wireframe and they need a comp first, but, I think it's important because if the client can't see where, let's say, all the blocks are going to appear and maybe how they're going to be labeled or whatever, they may have a different picture in their head than what you have in your head as the developer, the designer. And, you know, when you're done and you put it in front of them, they're like, well, that's not what I imagined. That's not what I wanted. But the wireframes allow you to, you know, to quickly put something together, whether you're on a whiteboard, whether big piece of paper with post-it notes or using some high-end graphic development tool. I think wireframes are very important.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it doesn't matter how big or how small your client is. You need some type of, you know, wireframe communication.
Yes.
Just for the reason you mentioned before. It's just to make sure everybody's on the same page.
Managing expectations.
There you go. I can't believe it's the first time we've actually said that phrase in this podcast,
really?
Managing expectations. Because it seems like that, I know when I do project management with our clients, that's what it's all about, managing expectations.
Absolutely.
That's what all of this stuff is for when it comes down to it. So there are a couple things you mentioned and didn't mention in the book. And I'm going to give you the out before I even mention what they are. I'm pretty sure it's because of the time frame of when the book came out. But you talk about a module called the Composite Layout Module, which I actually had to go back and look up.
Yeah.
And once I looked at it, I realized, oh, that's like what I use Display Suite for now.
Yeah. When I first saw Display Suite for Drupal 6 a while ago, I looked at that and went, okay, no. That's not what I need. It wasn't ready for me. I didn't understand it. It wasn't as intuitive as I needed it to be for myself. You know, I'm not a coder. I didn't think like that. I just wanted a GUI drag and drop situation. And when I found Composite, you know, I used it. Now, what's different between – and now I've looked at Display Suite in 7. Oh, my God. Oh, I highly recommend it. When I'm teaching classes, we go over panels and, you know, we talk about Display Suite. It's – What's different about composite is a node by node situation. You node by node, you can lay out your nodes. Okay.
That's so that's kind of like Panelizer these days.
Yeah, it's the panels. This is, but it's so much more simple than using panels. The things that you need to know in order to use panels, it's not necessarily intuitive right off the top. But with composite, it's very, very straightforward. Right there in the node, everything's managed right there at the node. Unfortunately, I haven't seen it yet go to 7. I saw that Display Suite was looking just almost just like it, with this, choose your template, similar to how panels works. I was like, oh, okay, let's do Display Suite. But Display Suite's at the content type level, right. And composite's at the node level, one node at a time versus all nodes of a certain type. As far as efficiency goes, Display Suite is much better than composite. That might be actually why composite didn't go to 7. It was, it had already had its day. I don't know. I like Display Suite. I really do.
Yeah, I think kind of the way that a lot of people do it now when they need it on a per node basis is the Panelizer module.
I haven't played with that one yet.
Yeah, which uses panels, but it does it. You can override a single node and change the layout of a single node, which I think is kind of what the composite layout module did.
Okay, well, maybe that's another reason why I didn't go there. But, when I was writing this book, I was so into writing the book that I didn't have a chance to, because I was still trying to – most of the book was written before 7 was launched. And it was a scramble to say, okay, back. Yeah. And evaluate the modules as they were coming out and saying, looks like this is going to be ready or not, And so I tried to get some of the biggest ones. Because I hadn't played with Display Suite in 7 yet, completely forgot about it, to be honest with you. It didn't get mentioned. And I should, I regret not having mentioned it because it's really a good tool.
Well, I was thinking about it, and if the book was published in July of 2011, that means you were probably writing the book, about 2 years ago at this point, towards the end of 2010, beginning of 2011. Is that fair?
Yeah, I spent some time in 2010 writing it. That's when it was a website. They contacted me late in 2010, and I spent 7 to 8 months writing the book, starting like in December 2010, and we ended in May of 2011, May-June 2011, and that's where writing the book and doing all the edits.
So. And Drupal 7 had just come out earlier that year.
Yes. So I'm evaluating Drupal 7 and all its modules that are out while I'm doing, using the book and installing the modules and seeing how they work and, so I can comment on things. And so much to look at.
So another thing you mentioned, I'm going to bounce back to wireframes really quick here, was, depending on the scope of the project, sometimes you're actually choosing a theme before you create wireframes. I thought that was interesting because that's actually something that we do, but I never really thought about why we do it sometimes. And it turned out to be one of those things where, clients on a smaller budget where you're going to be using an off-the-shelf, a contrib theme or maybe a purchase theme where you don't have the flexibility in the layout that you would have with a pure custom theme, you need to know the theme before you can start drawing wireframes. Do you find that that's pretty common as far as it has to do more with the scope of the project than anything else as to which one you do first?
Yes. Yeah. That's one of the first questions I ask my client is, I ask them, do you have a budget for a theme? And those who understand that question, the answer or not, sometimes we have a conversation on what that means. And when they say no, I said, well, let's find one that you like the best and we'll walk through the pros and cons of each one with respect to, restricting our layout plans and so on. Just because the theme is limited, doesn't mean there's, aren't other options like panels, now we have Display Suite and so on.
All right, so the other thing I noticed about the planning your website section was there was very little, if any, mention of responsive theming. And I'm going to guess it's kind of the same situation where, 2 years ago, as you were writing this book, responsive theming was just starting to take hold. But knowing what we know now in the Drupal community and how pervasive responsive theming is, I mean, where does that kind of fall in the planning? You know, how would you change, I guess, part one of your book with, you know, everything that we know about responsive theming these days?
I would have a section in there that says, you know, now that you know one of your layouts, plan the other two. Because it's what it means. I mean, you have, you know, you can have more than three layouts, but that seems to be the pattern. That was Zen, how he has the three stages. Omega has the three stages, you know, desktop, tablet, phone. I would bring that up. I would introduce that concept. I would introduce the concept of that, you know, we no longer are having to pick and choose, you know, and say, oh, we only want this section of our site on mobile because that's all we can get. Where, you know, with responsive theming, you can, you know, have one theme doing it all. You know, you don't have to have three themes and picking and choosing what shows or doesn't show, you know, manually, because you're having to manually configure this phone theme versus manually configuring the tablet theme versus manually configuring the desktop theme. So I would introduce those concepts. But, you know, when people bring up responsive, I do think about my book. It's like, okay, I have this one section on now go mobile. And, you know, yeah, it's kind of the backwards way of thinking for a lot of people now. Some are still desktop first, but it's still the same process. You know, you ask yourself, okay, how do I want information to conveyed here versus there? You know, so whether you start on the phone and go to the tablet and go to the desktop, or you start with a desktop and go to the tablet and go to the phone, you're still asking the same questions. Does the menu structure need to change? And how is that layout going to be when I have the menu structure? And, you know, what blocks are going to be, you know, available, you know, on the phone versus a desktop? And why aren't they available on the phone? If they're not on the phone, then why do we even need them on the desktop? So you understand the meaning or the purpose of a desktop interface versus the phone. And sometimes there shouldn't be a difference, and sometimes maybe there should be. You know, the reason why people come to desktop is to perform a task that should be performed on a desktop or should be performed on a tablet. So it's the same process. You start back at potentially, for some people, all the way back at requirements and go through, maybe not all the content, but, you know, the general features that you want available. And then, you know, start chapter five all over again. What do you want this interface to look like, and what purpose will it serve? So I would introduce that stuff, but I wouldn't change a whole lot.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, that's kind of interesting, because I think there's a lot of, well, I say it's interesting because for, and yeah, I think I'm speaking from experience a little bit. We've kind of adopted the whole mobile first strategy with our clients. And we're not doing it. We don't do it because we think mobile is more important than desktop. We use it as a tool to kind of trick the client into telling us what's most important.
That's interesting.
Yeah, if we wireframe the mobile site first, then, you know, the client has a lot less, you know, screen real estate to deal with, and we basically get to say, okay, you have to tell us what's most important, because only one or two things is going to fit, you know, on the mobile site before someone has to start scrolling. So we kind of, you know,
I tried that recently.
Yeah,
I tried to go mobile first. The client wouldn't let me.
Even in the planning phase.
Even I was like, well, you know what? So we're going to, how do you want your mobile, you know, to be? What's most important here? And we're not going to be on mobile. We're not concerned with that. And I'm like, okay. So, and then I had a client before that. And it's like, okay, you want a mobile site, you know, so let's talk about that so we can, you know, plan accordingly, you know, because the desktop is easy. And it's like, no, whatever works on the desktop will work on mobile. And so I was like, really? Okay. So it's smaller, yeah. But you can still see it. I mean, so it wasn't a really complicated desktop. Okay. In all, you know, honesty. Mm-hmm. But, I haven't had as much luck getting people to think in mobile first. But the process is still there. I mean, you can choose desktop first, tablet first, or mobile first. It doesn't matter. The process is still the same. You need to plan what it's going to look like. You know, take into consideration the blocks and how they lay out and if you're going to show them or not, and your images and how big they are. And you ask the same questions when you're on a desktop. You know, you have, although it's much more space, you still have a limitation on the desktop. So, I think in general the process is the same, but
Andrew, what do you guys do at MediaCurrent? Do you guys find that you're able to design for mobile first and then bring the client, start talking about desktop?
Yeah, we generally try to aim for mobile first for the same reason of just trying to get them to focus on what's important, and everything after then is, well, I don't want to use the word filler, but it's not as important.
Right.
So then it can be a little bit of a lighter decision. It's kind of, you know, getting them over the 80% hump.
Yeah. All right. Well, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was going to just say, but you know, your first comment right at the very beginning of this was, you know, timing wise. Yes, that's for the most part the reason why the book doesn't start with mobile or have that, you know, concept in it is because it was very early in right. The community adopting, you know, responsiveness. So.
But like you said, I don't think it matters that much. It doesn't make the book any less relevant at all. Because the book really is about the tools, the methods, rather than the, you know, the specific requirements.
I don't know. I'm still wondering how to build that view.
Which view? So that covers part one of the book. So let's take a 15-minute intermission here. Let people go get some popcorn, and then we'll come back and cover the next section of the book. And then,
excuse me.
Yeah, and then we'll end up with a 4-hour podcast. So that'll be fantastic.
I was hoping you would have on the soundboard the "Let's go to the movies."
Let's all go to the
The lobby.
Yeah, it was a lobby.
Yeah, let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't have that one.
Okay.
But so let's summarize, because you know we've been talking for about a half hour, and we can continue, but let's not. So this book is definitely, if you're doing Drupal project management, I feel this is one of those books you should have on your bookshelf. Similar to if you are developing in Drupal, you should have, you know, the definitive guide to Drupal 7 on your bookshelf. It kind of has that type of information. And Cindy, like you said earlier, it's thick with examples and details that may or may not be relevant to all shops. But for people who don't do project management as their primary job, for people who are kind of jacks of all trades and who are the ones out there getting the clients and helping them with the requirements and building the site, you know, I think there's definitely some easy wins that, you know, developers can get from reading this book. It's got a lot of good information that can kind of make the planning part of the project a lot more efficient. And the part of the book that we didn't cover, and maybe Cindy, you can just kind of give us a sneak peek at it, is actual building and sustaining the website. You know, as it's built, you know, the testing and you have a whole section on, you know, different servers that can be used as far as a testing server and a content server and a staging server and development server. I mean, the book is just thick with information like that. What kind of things do you cover in that in part two?
In part two, it's more along the lines of awareness. Just making sure you're thinking about things, introducing concepts. Like, so for example, you'd mentioned the multiple server environment. If a client doesn't understand that, and the client has bought this book, so they can plan accordingly, they'll understand what their developers are going through. You know, how they're developing on multiple machines and how all that comes together. So it's just conceptual things to remember, things to think about, things to discuss with your client if you're the developer, or things the client should discuss with their developer to understand, you know, for example, testing, you know, when and will the client be involved in the testing and when won't they and why, and what does it mean to change something and have to retest it? And then the implementation, there's quite often it's, you know, overlooked, you know, who needs to be trained. And a website can actually trigger an organizational restructuring. I mean, some websites are that big. And sometimes, you know, management who says, I'm going to build, you know, my organizational website, they forget about that. So it gives some tips in here for thinking about that. You know, have you really thought about whether or not this is going to change? And then, you know, I did a little bit of instructional design, you know, stuff, and telling people how to write an objective and to plan, you know, how to train people. And then sustaining, the whole difference between upgrading and updating, monitoring your logs, you know, making sure that, you know, people aren't coming at you and trying to hit your site and causing problems. So yes, there's work to be done after a site is launched. And sometimes, even though, you know, you think the work is just adding content, there's other things that need to be done. And so this book reminds you of that.
All right. Well, it's available pretty much everywhere you normally would buy Drupal books, Amazon, and it's available online, and we'll have the links in the show notes. So, Cindy, you're going to stick around for the rest of the podcast, I hope. We haven't driven you away at this point.
Nope. I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Andrew, what's next?
We have some Drupal Easy news.
Yes, we do.
Drupal in the morning, Drupal in the evening, Drupal at supper time. All I do is Drupal all the time. Add another module, get another feature, add another field or two. If you want a slideshow, just wrap it in a view. When you need a website, Drupal is the key. If it's too confusing, then you can hire me.
So,
Drupal in the morning, Drupal in the evening, Drupal is what I do. I love all my classmates, the lab is such a zoo. Get up in the morning, brush my teeth, and Drupal that basketball. All I do is Drupal, 'cause Drupal is my call. And if you need more training, then Mike is who you call.
That was excellent.
How about that?
I love it.
That was actually written and sung and recorded by two of our Drupal Career Starter Program students. And they actually performed that at our graduation, but we didn't get a good recording of it, so I asked them to re-record it, and they just didn't send it to me. So that was Gus and Marsha from the Drupal Career Starter Program, and that was, you know.
Will we have links available for people who want to download it?
It's actually available on YouTube already. Okay. So I will put the link in there. Absolutely hysterical the first time. Laughing my head off the first time I heard it. Laughing with joy, not out of, you know, not pointing and laughing, but, you know.
You enjoyed it so much.
I did. It was, you know, really fun. So I want to thank them. And that's all the news I want to have.
Awesome. Well, I mean, how can you follow that?
Yeah, you can't.
Well, how about we break into our... Well, what we would normally call our four stories, but in an effort to save electricity, we're calling it three stories this week.
Perfect.
Okay. So the first story we have is the CMI fundraising update. And I always forget what CMI stands for.
Configuration Management Initiative.
Okay. For some reason, I have a hard time with the I. I don't know why.
Yes. So this is one of those stories that it's a feel-good story. We should have like feel good music, but
oh yeah,
it's not really a technical, you know, article or anything. But
doesn't tell us how to build any views.
No, that's pretty much the theme for our podcast today. We're not going to tell you how to do anything, you know, specifically. We're just going to give you, you know, big round feel good ideas.
Hey, we must be consultants.
That could be.
Okay,
we should charge a lot for it. Yeah. So the Configuration Management Initiative is a Drupal 8 initiative to make the handling of Drupal configuration stuff easier. I don't want to get into all the details, but it's a fairly significant initiative. It's
a big part of Drupal 8.
Yes, and it's, you know, it's going to be fantastic for moving sites between a dev, test, stage, production, server environments. So the guy who is kind of in charge of the initiative is this guy named Greg Dunlap. And he actually has been working on CMI exclusively for the past few months. When he first started the initiative, his company, which was Node One at the time, donated 50% of his time to work on this code. He has since left Node One, and he actually was able to fundraise enough money to pay his salary independently so he can continue working on CMI through, I believe, April of next year. Which is, you know, quite amazing, because in the blog post, he talks about how other big open source projects generally have a company behind them who does the bulk of their core development. And he talks about Canonical with Ubuntu, a company called TenGen with MongoDB.
Yep, Mozilla.
Red Hat and Mozilla Foundation. And the fact that Google supports a number of open source projects. But Drupal doesn't really have that. Drupal has Acquia, but it's a slightly different role. Acquia is very particular about, you know, what the, I don't want to say this in a negative light in any way, because it doesn't, I'm not meaning it, I don't mean to say it in a negative light. But they're very particular about the things that they put their resources behind.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair way of saying it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I would say, I mean, they have finite resources just like all other companies out there. So they get to pick it. Well, they pick and choose what they feel is right.
Right. But Greg was able to go out to different organizations, including Acquia in this case, and raise, you know, he doesn't give a dollar amount, and he probably shouldn't have to as well, but raise enough money to pay his salary so that everybody in the community is going to be able to benefit. And he talks about the fundraising drive, how it began a little bit, how he met and surpassed the goal. And he mentioned some of the companies, including Acquia, Web-Enabled as well, who's, you know, our sponsor for this podcast, as well as a number of individuals who have donated. And I just thought it was really, really interesting how he was able to do something which I think a lot of people dream of doing, and that is, how can I get paid to work on Drupal community projects?
Yeah.
That are normally volunteer projects.
Promised land.
Yeah, and he figured it out. And it's kind of cool, like in the last paragraph of the blog post, he talks about how he met someone and he said he was a software engineer, but then the person asked who he worked for. And he didn't really have a good answer until he said, oh, well, I work for the Drupal community, which is, you know, if you were looking for a client, that's a pretty darn good client to have.
I don't know. If I was him, I would have made it a little more grand and say, I work for the world, for the betterment of humanity.
Yes. He wasn't thinking, obviously, when he said Drupal community. I work for you, man.
Yeah, but so, no, it's incredibly awesome that he's able to do this. And for just to bring up kind of the counterpoint, because we do have a Drupal Association, but they don't fund coding or that type of thing. They're more about the events and the community. They don't touch Drupal code. Is that right?
Yeah, it's in their I don't know if it's in their mission, but they do not pay for code. You know, they don't want there to be any indication at all that the association is driving the direction of code development.
Yep.
They are just here to support the community and organizing events and, you know, paying for, you know, servers and stuff like that.
Yeah. And just as a disclaimer, I didn't want this to be like a negative thing. I just wanted to point out that it's not their turf.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And I don't think it is a negative thing. But it's a really cool story. And, you know, we're lucky to have people like Greg and organizations like And I'll just list off the first few that are listed here: Acquia, Riot Games, Bluehost, Dennis Publishing, Pantheon, Web Enabled. And I'm going to read the last four since that's the whole list. Reload.dk, Anertech, Compress, GmbH. I'm not sure what GmbH stands for. And undpaul.de. Those apparently are the companies that have donated financial resources to Greg so he can continue working on CMI pretty much full time through the release of Drupal 8. So it's great. It's exciting. I'd love to see more things like this in the future. Because the people who lead these initiatives, if they don't have a company who's kind of cooperating with them and donating at least some of their time, you know, these people have no lives other than work and Drupal community work. To be able to, you know, yeah, it would be great if in the future it wasn't just one person that was, you know, would be able to do this. It would be great if there was like a handful of people who get to work on Drupal full time for the community and get paid for it.
Definitely. The world would be a better place.
Yes, it would.
Unicorns and butterflies. Happy night. Okay, well, how about we move on to our next story, which is going to be fun to put a happy tint on it. It's the simple anti-spam module. You put this one in here, Mike.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about making this my pick of the week. But then I realized, okay, well, I haven't actually used this module too much.
Uh-huh.
But it just, the idea of the module just got me thinking and it led me to a little bit of research. So I thought it might be a good, you know, kind of a fun thing to talk about. So the simple anti-spam module, all this module does apparently is adds two checkboxes to forms. And I think it's primarily meant for like comment forms or user registration forms, where one checkbox says, I'm not a spammer, and it's visible.
Okay.
And the other checkbox says, I am a spammer, but it's hidden using CSS. So the idea is that if a spam robot comes to the site, if they check both of them, then you know they're a robot and you can discard that comment. Hmm. If they check only the first and not the second, then they're most likely a real person. And granted, it could be a real person adding spam to your site, but at least you know it's not a robot. Or
yeah, but in that case, a regular captcha would still fail in its place.
Right. Or if they check just the first one, that I'm not a spammer, but not the second one, you could be reasonably sure that, again, they're not a robot.
Or a smart aleck.
Or a smart aleck. So it led me to, you know, even the module even mentions a similar module called Honeypot, which kind of does a similar thing. And we're kind of in the process of re-architecting the Drupal Easy site into 7. And I'm, you know, we've always dealt with comment spam and we're using Malum, but, you know, stuff gets through. So I'm thinking about, well, can we use different modules in combination? So I thought I'd ask, you know, you guys, you know, what have you used as far as either a single module or a combination of modules to combat spam? And kind of what are some of the things that you think help? So Andrew, you want to take a stab at that first?
Yeah, I mean, I've used tons of modules out there, from Malum to CAPTCHA with ReCAPTCHA. I've used a couple even like blacklisting type modules out there that if they hit like a honeypot page or something like that, they're essentially blacklisted from submitting forms.
Right.
The one I've always wanted to materialize is, there was as many years ago, but someone came up with the idea of asking which picture is not a kitty cat.
Oh,
and
right.
Like
right.
9 pictures, and you just click on one because it'd be harder for the machines to determine if, you know, one's a fox or something like that. I don't know whatever happened to that, but I think it had some issues with 508 compliance.
But, I mean, it seems like solutions like that, the problem with solutions like that is there's so much spam these days. It's being generated by real people.
Yeah.
Who are, you know, probably, you know, unfortunately, like sitting in some type of spam sweatshop, you know, and just, you know,
disturbing
going
picture.
To, yeah, mm-hmm. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
you know, what are, I mean, how do we combat that?
I suggest to my clients that they don't want to have people just anonymously posting things, that they configure their sites to force them to create an account, force them to log in, force them to check their email to get their account. So they're, at least they're making an effort. And then after that, if you find there's a spam shop out there with people sitting in front of computers spamming and they're hitting your site for some reason, then you turn your comments on to review, and nothing gets published unless you've approved it. And that limits, so you can get the real comments show up on your site, and the ones that were just spamming don't show up then.
Yeah, but the scary thing about doing that is the people who are sitting there manually creating spam can just as easily create an account on your site and click a link in an email to get it confirmed.
They can, but every time it takes longer, you're actually raising the cost. The reason that those spam sweatshops are effective is just because they're so cheap. You know, they can submit 200 spams an hour for a few cents. But if you make that step, take a minute per, you've just drastically cut into their profit.
Right.
Well, and you also have to look at the purpose of what people you really want commenting on your site. I mean, do you have it turned on just because, oh, I wonder if someone will come and comment? Or are you really trying to get some interaction on your site, if that's the plan? Because sometimes, there's only certain people that really should be commenting on your site, and you can actually have the accounts approved. You can pre-screen, so you can see who these people are, make them fill out a form. Now, of course, they can fake their name and all that kind of stuff, but it's yet one more step. It slows them down in the process, where you have trusted people on your site commenting.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I was going to say, for Drupal Easy, we should actually put trivia questions about the podcast. If they can answer that, then they can post a comment.
All right, let's put that on my Open Atrium task list of stuff to do, is to come up with 30-something, podcast trivia questions.
Yes.
Yes. All right, I'll get right on that. So have either of you used a Honeypot module or similar type module that adds these kind of silly little checkboxes?
I haven't directly.
I haven't, but I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued to see what,
I read it. I'm like, that's kind of interesting.
I would love to see a anti-spam type blog, kind of like, how they're database performance type blogs, to see what the numbers are of different approaches and what they've actually been able to do.
Right. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, that was all I wanted to talk about for this story. I just thought, there's so many different ways to combat spam. What's working, what's not working. And I think the consensus is, and it makes sense, is, we're not going to be able to stop it, obviously. But if you can do things to slow it down, to increase the cost, that probably is, that's probably the biggest hammer we have at this time.
Okay, well, how about we move on to our third and final story? Again, well, I guess I've got a nice light for this one. The next one is Drupal 7.17 was released. And the good news is it's not a security fix, so you don't have to upgrade if you don't want to. But they fixed a whole lot of bugs and added in some new functionality. So you might not have heard about it just because it wasn't a security release. But there is a new version of Drupal out there. Have you been able to install it yet, Mike?
I haven't installed it anywhere yet. And the reason why is because normally before I do one of these updates is I like to look at the diff files. Okay. And just see what's changed. So I'm going to give you a great example is with 7.16, and that was a security update.
Yes.
I installed that one almost immediately on, all my client sites, because it was, when it came down to it, it was literally one line of code that changed. And that line of code was in the install.php file. So it was one of those updates that, it wasn't going to break anything.
Yeah.
And once I saw that, I'm like, okay, well, let's just roll this out immediately. And, within, a couple hours, like every site I needed to, it was updated. When I looked at the release notes for this one, I mean, if you look at the, you know, major changes in 7.16 section, and then the all changes since 7.16 section, I mean, there has to be, what, maybe 100 changes?
There are quite a few.
Yeah, so this is one of those updates that, you know, this is something that we're going to apply for our clients, but it's going to be in a test environment for at least a week or two.
Exactly.
Because there's a lot of little changes in this one. The nice thing about these updates is that in the release notes, they're very explicit about whether or not the .ht access or robots.txt file has been modified. Mm-hmm. And that's really helpful because if you're going to hack core, that's where you're going to end up hacking core, which is, I'm going to put hack core with a little asterisk next to it.
Yeah.
Because it's not really hacking core. It's, you know, it's customizing your site.
Yeah, and it's very common to have those modified. Yeah,
extremely common. So this is probably a fairly easy release to push out, but it's definitely one of those releases where I'm looking at it going, okay, we need to do some serious testing on this to make sure it didn't break anything, yep. Especially if you're using custom modules or modules that are, you know, very far outside the top 200, 250 most used modules.
Yeah, I agree. So, and it's not a security release. So people out there listening, you have time to test this.
Right.
And don't do it on your production server, please.
No, please. Please. I was going to ask Cindy, so releases like this, you know, where do these fall in as far, you know, in going back to your book and the sustaining a website stuff? Do you guys, I mean, is this something where you'd recommend, I don't know if you recommend is the right way of saying it, but actually having some type of procedure to go through when, you know, because we have an internal procedure for our, you know, that we do when one of these updates comes out. But as far as the client, should the client be prepared to spend a little bit of money to do the testing and do the due diligence in order to make sure that rolling out a release like this is, you know, isn't going to do anything bad?
Of course. I love the process that you use, you know, evaluate. Yeah. I do the same thing. I open it up and say, what's changed? And, you know, if it's minor things that have changed that aren't going to affect, you know, the rest of the site, then I go ahead and install. But if it's, you know, significant changes, and I know potentially I have a lot of customization or I have modules that touch, you know, some of that functionality that's changing, I'll put it on a dev server and test it out before for updating. And I think that's something the clients don't understand quite often about any website, especially from the HTML world. You know, there's no code to update, if you will, but in this world there is, and there's a cost associated with it. If they're not going to do it in-house and therefore spend the money to have someone in-house, they need to spend the money to have someone else do it for them. Potentially the dev shot who did the development.
So is it safe to assume, and I'm trying to like scroll through this PDF right now, but I know you're going to know off the top of your head. Do you cover these type of updates in part two of the book?
I don't explain how it's done, but I explain the differences and that it needs to happen. You know, it's part two of the book is a big shopping list of options and things to remember and things to do. It's not necessarily how to do them.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. So web-enabled.
Yes. Webenabled.com.
Yeah. So the one thing I was going to mention about web-enabled on this podcast is I actually talked to a couple of people over the past couple of weeks who didn't realize that web-enabled actually did production hosting. Yeah, we talk about their development hosting and their repositories and permissions and, you know, having different members of a team on different projects on web-enabled, but they actually also do production-level hosting for sites of all sizes. So a lot of times when we have smaller clients who, you know, are hosting on other servers or other services right now, I guess is the better way of saying it, and they're not completely satisfied. For us, it's a really easy sell for us to say, look, we're going to have a development site with this firm, with web-enabled. If you'd like, when we're ready to go live, you can, you know, contract with them to do your production hosting. And then we'll just switch your domain name over at the right time. But it makes it really, especially for smaller clients, it makes it a really easy decision because it's someone who we have a lot of experience with. They have a lot of experience hosting Drupal websites. And it's literally just a couple of clicks to push our repository and our database from a development server to a web-enabled production server. So it makes the whole process really fast. Their prices start, I think, at $10 a month for shared hosting, which is, you know, pretty darn good and pretty competitive with some of the other
Drupal world.
Yeah. And they scale up to, you know, virtual private servers and things like that as, you know, client needs get bigger. But definitely check them out for production hosting. And that is webenabled.com.
Excellent. So you can also find all these links that we're going to be talking about at drupaleasy.com/podcast. Wow. Is there a requirement that I forget the a URL every single podcast?
I think it's a requirement you change it just a little bit every URL.
Yeah, that's true. That'd be fun. Yeah,
we should. Throw a random number in there.
Okay, you ready for a new sound effect?
Do it.
Okay, and now it's time for Picks of the Week. Do you like that?
That was fantastic. That was great.
Yeah, I don't want to tell how much time I spent this weekend setting that up. So now it's time where each of our hosts shares with you a module, a theme, even a blog post or a book they read. So it's just something that we think is very interesting, and we hope that you do too. Mike, how about you kick us off this week with your pick of the week?
Yeah, so my pick of the week is a theme. And I don't think I've ever picked a theme before as my pick of the week. Maybe, like, I'm sure at some point we've picked Omega or Zen. I'm not sure if it was me or not. But this theme, I'm pretty sure I've never picked like a usable contrib theme out of the box, download it and use it on your site today type of theme.
Okay.
And that's exactly what this one is. It's called Responsive Blog, and it's relatively new. It was written by someone named Pradeep Saran, S-A-R-A-N. And it's just, it's a really, really nice, clean, simple, responsive theme that's ready to go out of the box. It renders really nice on mobile devices. I like the typography. I like it because it's very simple and very clean. It has a few like of the little nice features. It has like social media links up in the right in the header. And they're all very consistent looking and clean and
minimal.
I like it a lot. And it was written by, so Pradeep made the first commit on this only 7 weeks ago. So it's a relatively new theme, but I thought we'd give it a shout out just because we actually used it on one of the mini projects at the end of our class. And usually when I have 20 people using a theme, I find issues with it. And I don't think really anybody found any issues with this theme in our class, which is saying something, because normally when you have people new to Drupal trying out something, they find things that other people generally don't find.
Yeah.
But we all had a really good experience with this, and it's a lovely little theme, so I think people should check it out. It's called Responsive Blog.
I'm taking a look at this, and I think this is something that that Drupal needs more of. We have plenty of nice theme, I don't know, like the Omegas and all those types of things that are parent themes for you to create sub themes. And then we have very, very specific themes for you to use that are like for technology sites that talked about left-handed basketball players.
Yes.
But there aren't that many good generic ones that you could use just for like a blog, or you could probably use it for other reasons too. But we need more of those.
Yeah, I think the word you're missing there, though, is we need more of these generic responsive ones.
Well, yeah, that's icing on the cake.
Right. I mean, there's plenty of them out there that are just, you know, good generic themes. But the other one actually we played with a little bit is Corolla, which has been around forever. But the Corolla theme is responsive as well. And that's another really, really clean theme. And we're actually going to be using it for, we have a small little job coming up And we're actually going to use Corolla as the base theme because we just have to make very minimal changes to it. But it's, you know, it's fantastic. It's clean. It's responsive. It has nice typography, and it's going to be a cinch to create a sub theme and make our little tweaks and be done.
Who could ask for anything more?
Who could? So that's my pick.
Awesome. Should I have to try that one out? It looks kind of fun.
All right, cool.
My pick of the week is a blog post, and this is one, well, Mike, you and I know about it because we've worked on some of these submodules for it, but commerce shipping... I'm sorry, go on.
I would say this is a big moment for us.
Yes. Commerce Shipping 2.0 is out. So Commerce has had shipping since, I guess, the 1.0 days. But the shipping module has taken a while to get all the things that it needs to have in there. So a lot of the modules like FedEx and UPS have been waiting or have been out there. But they say, you know what, we need the Shipping 2.0 module. So you need this release past this date and a bunch of other wild hoops for users to jump through. But now the official release for shipping is version 2.0. So we don't have to jump through all those hoops, and it's much easier for end users.
Right. And the dev version of Commerce Shipping for at least a year, if not more, there's been a 2.0-dev version for a long time. And so it sounds like that Ryan Zarama, over the past month or so, finally had some time to kind of focus on getting Commerce Shipping to where it needs to be. And this is great because this is, you know, the module that Andrew and I co-maintain along with Andy is called Commerce UPS module. That hasn't had an official release yet, only because Commerce Shipping 2.0 hasn't had a release. And I believe the same thing is going to can be said for Commerce FedEx and Commerce USPS.
And I think the flat rate module too.
Oh, and the flat, yeah. So it's a big day for, you know, Commerce Shipping modules.
Hey, Commerce Shipping 2.0 shipped.
Woohoo! Oh, I get it. It's a pun.
Yes.
The shipping module shipped.
I'm very punny.
It took me a second. I'm sorry. I'm reading ahead to the next pick. That's my problem.
Okay, Cindy, and how about your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is a blog post from Karen Stevenson of Lullabot. It was just fabulous. The new organic groups for Drupal 7 really, really is different than the organic groups for Drupal 6. And,
very different.
Oh, my gosh. And so I've been trying to get my head wrapped around it. And I read her blog post, and I'm like, oh, I get it. Okay. I guess it's not that hard after all. So I want to thank Karen. Karen, if you're listening, very good. Very good. I loved it.
Yeah, this is Lullabot does a really nice job, and I think it's because they have a lot of internal review process for these blog posts to make sure that they are as clean as can be. And this one especially, I remember reading this one when it came out, and I think it's been out for quite a while. Let me look at the date. Oh, yeah, it's been out for almost a year, actually. Oh,
and I've just found a link to it on LinkedIn. I was reading a LinkedIn discussion, and someone posted it and went, oh, let me check that out. And I'm like, oh, okay. So yeah, a little late, but...
Yeah, I'm hoping this is linked to from like the official documentation page on for organic groups. But along the speaking of organic groups, I actually watched a screencast,
yeah,
from Drupal Camp is it Montreal or Toronto now?
You're saying?
Yes, America's Hat. That's awful. Oh my gosh! All the nice things you've done, you've just not gotten yourself, in trouble.
Which is funny because I love Canada.
Yes,
I like to call it Canadia.
Anyway, so the maintainer for organic groups, Amitai Bernstein, recently gave the keynote at, I believe it was Drupal Camp Montreal. I actually tweeted about it over the weekend. I should go back and look. If you haven't seen like a presentation by Amitai, it's an event at this point because he has got just an absolutely fantastic sense of humor. And it's definitely like for an over 17 type crowd, like an R-rated type of humor. But in the process of being very humorous, he ties everything back into organic groups and the way organic groups works and the way it's architected. And I have found I've learned more about organic groups from watching his presentations than from any other method. And you know, like you said, Cindy, you were being very kind when you used the word different. You know, and saying organic groups for 7 is very different than organic groups for 6. It's different, and it's much more complex, but it's also much more powerful. So
definitely powerful.
And I just heard in from our fact-checking desk part of this election, and it was Montreal.
Okay, so I actually had that one right. Yes. I said Toronto at one point, but I think I'll find the link and I'll put it in the show notes though. But that's a great pick of the week. Anybody who needs to understand organic groups, don't install organic groups. that's the first thing you should not do. You need to like do your homework and understand what the heck you're getting into before you do anything.
It's good advice.
Yes. Don't install the module.
Yeah.
That's the advice. Okay.
And stay calm.
Stay calm.
Yeah, don't freak out.
Okay. Well, now it's time for our site of the week. And as we said in the last podcast, our site of the weeks are user submitted. So you can go to drupaleasy.com/site of the week. And you can submit your own sites, and we'll be glad to feature it. We review them every once in a while, and we generally say totally horrible things about your website. So please send them in. No, I'm just kidding about the horrible things. this week's site of the week is, I'm going to mess up just saying this. It's kind of a tongue twister. The HP Life e-learning site.
You did fine.
Okay. Well, I had to say it really slow because it's part of the HP Learning Initiative for Entrepreneurs.
That it is.
Oh.
You're doing fine. Keep going.
Yeah. More horrific discontinuity.
Yeah. So this one was submitted by Mike Caden. I hope I'm pronouncing it, or Caden, maybe. It's K-A-D-A-N. But anyway, according to Mike, here's exactly what he wrote. The site is designed for entrepreneurs, particularly in the developing world, to learn about starting a new business. Participants complete units that have multiple interactive components. So, you know, it's a way for people to learn how to become entrepreneurs.
This sounds a lot like the Drupal ladder for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, but it's okay. No offense to Drupal ladder. It's much prettier
than okay.
Drupal ladder is right now.
It's which a is very funny. Pretty site.
Yes, because I was just listening to the DrupalEyes.me podcast over the weekend as well. And Kay and Brian, who are the kind of the people who started the Drupal ladder, were on with Addy. And they were talking about how they would love for someone to contribute some time to making Drupal ladder pretty. But anyway, it's a really nice looking site. And what do we know about the site? We know that we don't know too much about how it was created, other than there was a content team and a development team, and Mike was one of the people on the development team.
And it's running Drupal 7.
It's running Drupal 7, and it's one of those sites that is making the world a better place. So for that reason alone is why I said, well, let's highlight this one, because it's the type of site that more people should know about.
Definitely, 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 definitely. Especially entrepreneurs.
Yes.
Okay, so Twitter. You can stalk us on Twitter at DrupalEasy. I'm at Andrew M. Riley. Ryan, who's absent this week, is Liberator with the 2.0 spelling. Mike is Altamike. Our sponsor is at WebEnabled. And Cindy, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Cindy MCQT.
Excellent.
That's what you asked?
Yeah. Yep. People can follow you there, find out more about your book or some of your other adventures on your Twitter profile. So remember, you can always find us. You can always find us at DrupalEasy.com/podcast. Or if you search for us as Drupal Easy in iTunes or in Miro or in Stitcher, since we're now there. You can also see what we might be talking about in the next podcast by going to Delicious and searching for Drupal Easy Podcast as a tag. There's still time to apply for the Drupal Association Community Cultivation Grants. And also there's Aaron Winborn's Special Needs Trust that you can donate to. We're going to have some upcoming podcasts. Are these all confirmed, Mike?
Those are, you can say all three of those.
All right. Okay. No super top secret stuff.
No.
Or unless we're cutting you in, then we have to kill you. I'm sorry, listener.
Man, that's two bad karma things you've said now.
Puppy dogs and ice cream.
I don't know, because you've said you called Canada America's hat, and now you want to kill our listeners.
Well, we're letting them in on a secret. So our upcoming podcast, we have Kendall Totten talking about theming and mobile menu options. And we have Addison Berry, who we've actually talked about a couple times in this podcast.
Yes.
And all-time favorite is Emma Jane Hogman, who will be talking about, I don't know, maybe knitting. Who knows? She does lots of stuff.
And Emma's name also came up in this podcast.
Yes. So. Wow. It's like we're foreshadowing our own podcast.
I think maybe we should be asking Emma about Cindy. Oh. And about that car trip to Toronto.
Yeah.
And see if they in fact did talk about what Cindy's next book should be about. Yes. Do a little fact checking of our own.
Mm-hmm, I like that.
Yes.
And I want to say a special thank you to Cindy McCourt, the author of Drupal, the guide to planning and building websites. So thank you, Cindy, for coming on. It was insightful and fun.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I guess that's the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say more. Are you sure you don't want to insult another segment of our listeners?
How about I just go, this is Andrew Riley for Drupal Easy Podcast number 93.
See ya.